You're listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find this episode encouraging.
Thank you so much, Kiri. It has been an epic adventure for me. So I'm hoping it will be of equal interest to your curiosity. So I'm Beth, and my pronouns are she, her. And tonight is the penultimate sermon in the Revelation series, which has been one of the most epic that we've tackled, and I have personally enjoyed so much. So just by way of brief recap or introduction, if you haven't been here. Revelation is a record of a vision that a man named John received from the risen Christ, and that was concerning the churches that was to be shared amongst Asia Minor churches around 100 AD or in our common era. And early Christians were really trying to wrestle with this problem of their belief in the risen Lord, but their lived experience of oppression under the Roman rule. So Revelation was intended to validate that struggle and also to encourage their perseverance, to like stick on to the end, because this is not the final story. Revelation is what Christine really helpfully shared, this like God, like divine light bulb, a revelation of how God sees the world when we're really struggling with how we're experiencing the world. So it was not intended as an ultimate doomsday prediction, though I have really enjoyed the entertainment value of conspiracy theories and apocalyptic films. That was not the original intention of Revelation. And so far in our series at NCC, like, we have found so much deep resonance with the timeless truths and tensions that we've come across along the way that John has shared. So I hope this will be a fun dive. Another John, a John Dominic Crossan, has really summed it up nicely in this one lovely quote. So eschatology, which is the study of like end times, the end of all things, it's not about the destruction of the earth, but about its transfiguration. It's not about the end of the world so much as the end of evil and bringing injustice to justice. That's where we're heading. And today, we're tackling another 5 juicy chapters, 12 to 16, and you'll be very pleased to know that we get exponentially quicker as we get towards the end of those chapters. But we're going to read through chapter 12 to get like a flavor of what's in the Bible. And you might recognize this one from last week. Joel shared kind of this beautiful pictorial summary of the whole of Revelation. Well, this takes us to end of chapter 16, that was done by the Bible Project. And you can kind of see these 4 repeating lines. Sorry if you're listening to the podcast, but we can see that chapter sort of 6 to 8, 9 to 11, 12 to 14, and then 15 to 16, they actually cover sort of repeating territory. And the purpose of that is to emphasize and then expand on the teaching. So you might hear echoes from previous weeks today. But today, in the ultimate like conclusion of chapter 16, we land in this final showdown in Armageddon. So it's pretty exciting, so you know where we're heading. The original audience listening to John's letter being read out in the early churches in Asia Minor would have been familiar with a lot of the imagery and themes that come out in our passage today. And they'd have known that from Old Testament passages, from the Gospels, and even from contemporary myths. So to get us on a level footing before we dive into the Bible, I just wanted to share one of these contemporary myths. Has anyone studied Greco-Roman mythology? Oh, we have a few familiar in this corner. I'm very impressed. You might know. Do you know the Homeric hymn to Apollo? Maybe vaguely familiar? So to bring us all on board, I want to just share this little myth. And we've got a couple of pictures up here that might help. So who has heard of the god Zeus? A few of us have heard of Zeus. So Zeus was like the king of the gods. And he had an affair with a woman called Leto. And she's pictured in that first image on the left. And she became pregnant with twins. And that understandably made his wife, Hera, pretty angry. So Hera summoned this like serpent dragon from the center of the earth to come and devour Leto's offspring as soon as they're born. But Zeus sent a wind to rescue Leto, and it carried her away to an island where she safely gave birth to her twins, Apollo and Artemis. So that's kind of the first picture. And then the second picture, later when Apollo grew up, he killed Python, that's the same serpent on the left as on the right, in revenge for trying to attack Leto. So now we're familiar with the myth at the time. See if you can recognize any similarities from that to the Bible passage that we're about to read. Would anyone like to read for us? Ah, oh, Rob, such an awesome reader. Do you want the microphone? I'll bring it to you. There are two slides.
Makes it easier. Revelation 12, 1 to 6. A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on its heads. Its tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that it might devour her child the moment he was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The woman fled to the wilderness, to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 260 days. The dragon pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. The woman who was given the 2 wings of a great eagle so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the wilderness, where she would be taken care of for a time, times and half a time, out of the serpent's reach. Then from his mouth the serpent spewed water like a river, to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to wage war against the rest of her offspring, those who kept God's commands and hold fast their testimony about Jesus.
Thanks, Rob. Pretty wild. And up here is a bit of a visual of that story. We've got a pregnant woman and a red dragon with a lot of heads looking scary. So what similarities did we notice between the myth and Revelation? Pregnant woman. Yes. Nailed it. Yes, red dragon coming after them. 100%. Dragon, python, meant to be the same. Does the dragon get the offspring? No. Yes, so the offspring are also saved. We have a little bit of a summary of kind of similarities. We have a birthing mother, an attacking monster, totally nailed it. The offspring are actually saved from that monster. But then in the first myth, there's a divine triumph when Apollo kills Python. Have we noticed that in the Revelation one yet? Not yet. So John has really cleverly set this up so that we expect the same ending in Revelation. We expect the serpent to be destroyed and we expect a divine triumph. We also have a lovely quote here from, you might remember Robin Whittaker from week 2 of our Revelation series. She has a beautiful quote. She says, "Rhetorically, John's use of myths does really important work to explain the suffering these Christian communities are facing. Instead of hostility and suffering being signs of God's abandonment, or perhaps worse, his impotence, they are reimagined as proof that God is winning. It totally flips the narrative. Really clever device." And then on top of that, in these few verses that Rob really beautifully read for us, we actually have a summary of the entire biblical narrative. So you might have thought when you see in the original language, the dragon is more like a serpent dragon or like a leviathan. You might have come across in other passages. So it's actually very reminiscent of the very beginning of the Bible. In Genesis, when the serpent, the snake, decides to target Adam and Eve. Right back at the very beginning. So the very first humans, if you remember from the creation narrative, they chose to follow the word of the serpent or the snake over trusting the word of God when they ate the fruit. So it kind of looks like at this stage, it looks like the snake or the dragon has already won. But God curses the snake in Genesis chapter 3, and his curse says, "I will put enmity or tension between your offspring and the woman's offspring. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel." So right from the beginning, the original audience of John's letter would have been remembering this prophecy and remembering that we've anticipated that animosity from the very creation, the very beginning of this slide. And we're also anticipating the promise to be fulfilled that one of Eve's offspring will bruise the head of the serpent. But as more offspring populate the earth and the drama of the Bible plays out, the poised dragon from Revelation gets so close, so many, many times to devouring the woman's offspring. And we can kind of parallel in the Revelation story, the woman as Israel or as God's people, because she's suffering. Israel and God's people have suffered a lot, but she's honored. God's chosen people were honored. She has the sun at her head, the moon at her feet, and she's wearing a crown which symbolizes victory on her head. She's symbolizing God's people. And then the dragon is symbolizing the devil or the serpent who wants to devour her offspring. And in Revelation, her offspring's kind of symbolized as Jesus. And if we think back to Jesus' life, when he's born on earth, he kind of comes into within reach of the dragon, and the devil or Satan tempts him in the desert, tries to devour him. But Jesus resists the temptation. And when he dies on the cross, again, it looks like the serpent has won, but he rises again and ascends to heaven out of reach of the devil, out of reach of the dragon or the serpent. So that's symbolized in Revelation when the offspring is whisked away up to heaven, safe from the dragon. So on this slide, we kind of have the major milestones of biblical history. Don't get too caught up in the detail. But it's amazing how this theme gets threaded throughout. This theme of the serpent trying to devour the offspring of the woman to prevent the promised Messiah who would finally destroy the serpent from coming. So we've looked at creation with Adam and Eve, and we'll look at the flood. So what comes next? By Noah's day, Genesis chapter 6, verse 5 reports that every inclination of the thoughts of mankind was only evil all the time. It looks pretty dire. Except for Noah and his family who were saved in the ark. It's a very brief highlights reel. Then we come along to Abraham, who is promised that he will be a father of many nations, but his wife Sarah is barren. But then at the ninth hour, God provides an offspring for them and they have Isaac. So the promised line is continued and we're still anticipating maybe this promised offspring will come. And then, this is pretty cool. I'd heard of two of these, but not the third. Then, as we come to like Exodus, Kings, and Jesus time, we come across three occasions when rulers try to destroy the divine line. If you've seen King of Egypt, maybe in the time of Exodus, you heard that the Pharaoh tried to kill all the boys, all the offspring under 2 years old. But Moses is saved. And he's rescued by Pharaoh's daughter to be raised in the palace in Egypt, of all places. And the promise continues. We might see an offspring come to destroy the serpent. Then in the time of the kings, I hadn't heard of this woman, but a one Queen Athaliah, who's daughter of Jezebel, whose reputation precedes her, she murders all divine offspring to try and usurp the throne successfully for a few years. But her grandson Joash is saved. And for 6 years, he's hidden away until he's old enough to take the throne, at which point he becomes one of the good kings of his time. So maybe the royal line will continue. And you might have heard of the time when Jesus was born and King Herod tries to destroy all of the boys under two throughout Bethlehem to neutralize the competition. But Joseph, Jesus' father, is warned to flee to Egypt of all places. So again, Jesus is spared. And it looks like at every stage, at every major milestone along the way, the serpent or the dragon who's poised to devour the offspring is going to succeed. But at every stage, like God jumps in and saves them at the last moment. And so we're still waiting for this promise to come true. This revelation into what's happening behind the scenes is really giving us a big picture into what's happening from God's perspective. While we're struggling, we can see why the struggle is so real. So from both the Python myth and the Genesis promise, we actually know how Revelation is going to end. We know there's going to be a divine triumph and we're just hanging out for it to happen. So underneath all the bizarre characters and happenings that Rob read out, there's actually a message of deep comfort for believers and for the church underlying the weird apocalyptic imagery. You might have come across Ephesians chapter, we've got half the quote. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12. Oh, the whole quote. Thanks, Chris. What a legend. It says, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood. It's not against what we can see. Our struggle is against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." So we've started to better understand the whole Bible message and our current struggle with this window into the spiritual revelation of what's happening. So it makes sense why the struggle is so real. Would anyone like to read the next little bit of Revelation, the middle bit we missed? Thanks, Sammy. Do you want the microphone?
"Then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our brothers and sisters, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down. They triumphed over him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore rejoice, you heavens and you who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short."
Thanks, Sammy. So the devil, the dragon, and his angels have tried to fight a war in heaven and have failed. I've got a little image here that might help visualize that. So firstly, it's worth pointing out that this battle does play out in heaven. So heaven is not some place untouched by evil, some pristine, perfect, removed place we might imagine. Heaven is familiar with our struggle. This war was fought in heaven. And secondly, we learn that so-called evil all comes from one source. We're not fighting a lot of different enemies. It turns out that the red dragon of Revelation, the ancient serpent of Genesis, the Satan of Job, and who tempted Jesus in the desert, the accuser, the adversary, the antichrist, the one who deceives the whole world, all of these are from one source. And that one source has just been booted out of the heavenly realms. And now that it's on earth, it is rampaging because it knows that its time is short. So the dragon wanted to devour the woman's baby. When it failed, it tried to devour the woman. And then it fought a war in heaven and it failed. So now that it's on earth and it knows that its permission to exercise its authority is finite and that his time is really short, it's focusing all of the rage that it can muster and targeting it straight at earth. Sucks to be us. But have you heard about Hitler's final stand when he knew that he'd lost World War II? At the very end of the war, when he knew he'd lost, things got way hotter. He just got way more vicious, almost trying to show any ounce of power and vindictiveness that he possibly could. But I wonder, for those brutalized by him, what if they knew that the ferocity of his final attack was actually evidence that he'd failed? And for the original church, those early Christians suffering under Roman rule, like, what if they knew that the ferocity of the devil's attack was actually evidence of his failure? It turns the tables. So we can trust that persecution is actually proof that the devil has lost and that Christ has won. Verse 10, John says, "The kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come." It's a reality. So for us today, perhaps struggling, the struggle is real, I know it, or facing opposition, maybe even from within the church, that's a really painful one. Can we also find encouragement from this revelation, from this window into the divine perspective of what's really happening and where we're all really headed at the end of the day? In the end, our God of love wins. So if chapter 12 was the cosmic war, the cosmic battle, chapter 13 zooms in to an earthly battle. And we get to meet two beasts. So the first, the two beasts derive their power from the dragon. So it's the same thing. All evil comes from the same source. When we meet these two beasts, they get their authority from what the dragon gives them. So the first beast we meet, we're not going to read any more of the Bible, we're going to speed up a bit, is this terrifying sea beast. He emerges from the sea and represents empire or government, such as Babylon or Rome. And this monster is actually a compilation of four monsters that we would have met in Daniel, if you're familiar with Old Testament texts. Daniel chapter 7 talks about four beasts that symbolize the big earthly kingdoms at the time. This monster is like a conglomeration of those. So when we reach Revelation here, with that repetition, we get this idea that we're seeing a vision of the cyclical and beastly nature of empire. Colonization, oppression, corruption. What did Joel say last week? Standard Tuesday. You know, there's nothing under the sun in 2024. So this sea beast, you can tell, has like seven heads, 10 horns, and 10 Persian-esque crowns. It utters great boasts and blasphemies against God and his people. And curiously, the sea beast sports a mortal wound, which means it's a deathly wound, symbolized by Harry Potter scar there, which is in imitation of the lamb, who we've met before, has a mortal wound. The lamb, Jesus Christ on the cross, mortal wound. And this one also looks like it's been healed. It's apparently still living and functioning. Also in imitation of the lamb, also in imitation of Jesus. So evil cannot in itself create or provide anything new or interesting. It only has the power to distort or destroy or warp any goodness or creativity that God has created in the first place. This beast, it succeeds in getting many to worship it. And verse 4, it says, many proclaim, who is like the beast? Who can fight against it? And they give all their loyalty to this beast because it looks impressive and it boasts impressively. So John warns us in verse 10 of chapter 13. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Don't let us be fooled by appearances. Someone like Goliath or like otherworldly leaders at the moment who look impressive and have very impressive boasts. It doesn't mean they deserve our loyalty. It doesn't mean they deserve the authority, even if they quote from the Bible. Because the devil also quotes from Scripture. And that's another great book that Robin Whittaker has written. Check it out. So John exhorts believers to look beneath the surface and to live by God's revelation and God's truth, not just what looks appealing or looks harmless or looks attractive on the surface. And this brings us to the second beast of chapter 13. And it's the one in the background on the right there. So it's meant to look like a lamb, though the sketch didn't quite capture that part. And as we've seen in many other times in Revelation, things are not as they appear. Because the next thing we learn, while it looks like a lamb, it talks like a dragon. So it's kind of like a dragon in sheep's clothing, if you will. And according to William Hendrickson, this beast, it has a harmless appearance, and for that reason is even more dangerous than the first. He described the first beast, which is in the middle there, derived authority from the dragon on the left, the first beast as the enemy outside. But this second beast is like the enemy within the community or the enemy inside. It represents the false prophets of the world seeking to redirect all praise and authority to the sea beast, to the dragon, to the devil. So you can kind of see it's performing impressive signs. That's the fire. And you might just see a little idol in front of the people there. It forces people to create idols to worship the first beast. And it's given the power to slay anyone who doesn't worship the beast and anyone who does worship the beast to be marked, to be branded on the forehead and on the right hand with the mark of the beast. And that mark is also known as the number 666. This is why I was excited to do the sermon. The number 666. It's triggered so much speculation. I mean, actually, my mum told me last week that when Medicare tried to introduce a Medicare number, everyone was like, no, 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 it's the number of the beast. We're all going to get the number and, like, we're going to, like, be in hell and branded, and now we have Medicare numbers and it's fine. And I also read that credit cards are evidence of being marked by the beast because we have numbers and we can be tracked by the government who's tracking us because they have the resources and they care. If you're interested in that, you can check out endtimeministries.com or not. You know, it's good to be widely read. But general consensus suggests that the number 666 is representative of the Emperor Nero, who had been around just before John's writing. And he had blamed Christians for the fire of Rome. If you were here in previous weeks, you might have heard about that. And that sparked persecution of Christians. So if you... Thanks, Sammy. If you look at the value of each Hebrew letter in his title, it actually adds up to 666, which is convenient for this theory. So it's plausible that 666 is symbolic of tyrannical rulers such as Nero. Might have legs. Take that if you will. But for me, the best explanation I read about 666 is, again, if you were here for previous weeks, the number 7 symbolizes completion or perfection. So if you're looking for a number that symbolizes falling short of completion or perfection, a number that's just so close to 7, but just so far, what number would you choose? 6. Right. So that's why the number 6, and then in triplicate, when things come in triple in the Bible, it's there for emphasis. So you might have remembered back from Revelation 4, when the angels are crying out to God, holy, holy, holy. It's like writing in underline, bold, and italics. It's like uber emphasis. So when you write 666, it's emphasizing. So in the way that Satan, the devil, has set himself up against God and can never succeed in being God, it's the same. It's the ultimate antithesis. So the number 6 is the falling short of reaching number 7. So 666 is the numerical way of saying failure, 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 next to the number 777 representing God, which is holy, holy, holy. And I really appreciated the music we had tonight, just saying. Like one of those songs, if you remember singing, like, I trust in God, and He will never fail. He will never, ever fail. That's what 7-7 means. Like, God can never fail. Even how things look, even how things feel, the suffering, the oppression, the struggle is real. But God can never fail. 7-7-7. But if you put your trust and hope in worldly power, in evil, in the devil, 666, it might feel good now, but it's going to fail, fail, fail. The marking, the branding on the forehead, on the right hand, kind of weird to us, But it's reminiscent of the seal placed on the foreheads of believers back in chapter 7, if you remember from previous sermons. And as we move into chapter 14, verse 1 also says, "Behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads." It would have also reminded early Christians of Exodus chapter 13, verse 9 that says, "And it shall be a sign for you on your foreheads," representing thoughts, "and a sign for you on your hands," representing actions, bringing in all these like themes and imagery. So in this vision, people are marked by either the name of the beast or the name of the Lamb and his Father God. The loyalty here is binary. You choose one name or the other. And the sobering reality is the default loyalty is towards the beast, towards earthly empire, towards impressive people who boast loudly of what they can achieve but don't deliver. Social media, you might have noticed in the news this week, again, the federal government has announced a parliamentary committee to inquire into the behaviour of platforms such as Facebook, X, TikTok, and how they're dealing with the content amidst fears that they're too willing to advertise harmful content and they aren't willing to promote trusted content since they've decided not to renew the contract with Australian news platforms and amidst the closure of the news tab on Facebook. So basically the concern is that social media is more worried about making money than about the impact on society and the best interests of its followers. I mean, social media is actually designed to incrementally manipulate our beliefs and our loyalty to align with whatever power or ideology pays. And that's how Cambridge Analytica won those elections and they decided those election outcomes. So when it comes to Revelation, it seems like that external beast, we can go back to that picture if you like, the external beast of empire or government has become a far more pernicious and pervasive internal issue in our day than John might have even imagined when he wrote Revelation. It's not that social media is evil, but I think we're all pretty clued in to ways that social media can look appealing and look harmless, like a lamb, but have a beastly influence in our lives. So, I mean, I'm asking myself, you know, does my phone get my first and last attention of the day? How do I feel after spending a long extended time on any platform? It's not a problem that we do it. I think the problem is more a lack of awareness around it and that we can just go to sleep to it. So once we get more aware, we might have more freedom in choosing how the platforms are used rather than those platforms deciding for us where our attention is going to go to the one that's going to pay the most. And in the least, I wonder if our phones or social media can have a beastly influence in just the loss of time that we give to our devices and different platforms. I heard that on average, adults give like 2.5 hours a day, and 17-year-olds, it's more like 6 hours a day to social media. And I just think, what if we could reclaim that time for something, like anything else? So it's a bigger question that we can tackle tonight, but it's an interesting thing to ponder as we look at this series and how the influence of empire and governments and powerful, wealthy platforms can filter like into our lives and really get into our thoughts at the first of the day and the last of the day and take so much of our time and energy. It's just a challenge to be more aware. Are we intentional about choosing that? And if you choose 6 hours a day, all power to you, great. But I just think we're not choosing and it's being chosen for us. But mercifully, the hope and the promise of Revelation still stands today also. Evil will end and love will win. So chapter 14 circles back to the new song of the redeemed. John sees the 144,000 saints gathered before the Lamb. And this, again, is not a literal number. Philip Wilcock helpfully says that earthly measurements are given to help us imagine something which is strictly unimaginable. So the number 144,000, it's actually 12 times 12 times 1,000. Trust me on that one. 12 representing the 12 tribes of Israel, which is like the complete number of God's people. So 12 squared is like complete number squared, writ large. And then 1,000, when John was writing, that symbolized utter vastness. So like when we say a gazillion, we're not trying to say a specific number. This is the number of saints who will be saved and no more. It's just we're trying to say a really ridiculously big number. Same goes for 1,000. So the number 144,000, when John writes, is literally saying a really ridiculously big number that is totally complete. And this number is actually just the first fruits of those who will be saved. It's not meant to be a final head count, as it were. There is a lot to cover in this passage. You're doing so well. If you need to take a stretch or have a drink, please go for it. And from last week, these were the Lamb's army waving palm branches, the peaceful warriors, if you remember. This week, they're described as virgins with no lie in their mouth. And again, plenty of ink has been spilt about virginity. But in this instance, John is using that as a symbol of their utter fidelity to God. And that is all he's trying to say in Revelation. There's a lot going on in that picture. But at long last comes the moment of final justice. You probably can't read the bit where it says Babylon is fallen. But in Revelation 14, verse 8, it says, "Fallen is Babylon the Great. Fallen is Rome. Fallen are the empires who have tried to oppress, and they're corrupted and they've taken advantage of their citizens. The ultimate fall." And problematically with that, everyone with the mark of the beast, it says, will drink the wine of God's wrath, and the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. And they have no rest. I'm going to deal with that in a moment. So the final harvest that was postponed in one of Jesus' parables comes with a final plague in Revelation. Seven angels with seven judgments. There's a bit of a picture there. This might sound a bit familiar from last week again, because Revelation 15 to 16 describes similar plagues from last week. Seven angels pour out seven bowls of judgments on the earth that dwarf those from Exodus. You might remember again Robin Whittaker. She sums it up nicely in this table in her beautiful little book, Revelation for Normal People. So we can note the supersizing in the comparison from Exodus to Revelation. So in Exodus, the Nile turns to blood, pretty bad. But in Revelation, the sea and the waters, like everything, turns to blood. Exodus, we've got frogs. Revelation, we have demonic frogs. Exodus, drop a couple, we have hail. Revelation, I converted it. We have the equivalent of hail weighing 343 grams each. Imagine the dent on the roof of your car with that rock of hail. Again, we've got demonic locusts. So Revelation really ups the ante on the Exodus plagues. But alas, much like Exodus, the refrain, "they did not repent," is the response. They are angry at God rather than taking it as an opportunity to reflect on their life choices. Exodus 16 verse 8 says, "They cursed the name of God who had power over these plagues, and they did not repent of their deeds." So what's left to do? But a final showdown at Armageddon. It's come, people. What thoughts or images come to mind when I say Armageddon? Bruce Willis. Thanks, Sammy. Anything else? Nailed it. The Lego 2 movie. Is it the end of the world? And all the toys get locked up and the play gets ended. Oh, it sounds like the end of everything good that the kids would have loved in playing with their Lego. Yeah, I asked a friend earlier and she was like, "Fire and brimstone and death." I was like, "Oh, yeah, that tracks. Armageddon seems like, as the dictionary defines it, a cataclysmic conflict likely to destroy the world or the human race." Doesn't say "and the human race," could be hopeful. But perhaps disappointingly, the real Armageddon actually means Hill Megiddo in Hebrew. Not even mountain, just a hill. And John's audience would have recalled a Megiddo incident back from Judges 4 to 5, which I didn't know about, so you can read the details later. But back in Hebrews, Judges 4 to 5, Israel had not a spear or shield to their name, and they were up against a massive Canaanite army of 900 iron chariots. And God pulls a miraculous win for the Israelites. So this is the kind of story that's in the back of the minds of John's original audience. And William Hendrickson beautifully says that Armageddon, it's not the cataclysmic conflict. Armageddon is the symbol of every great battle in which, when the need is the greatest and the believers are oppressed, that is the time when the Lord suddenly reveals his power in the interests of his distressed people and defeats the enemy. That is the meaning of Armageddon. At the end of the day, no matter what things look like, what the odds look like, God will win. But we still have a bit of a problematic issue in Revelation, to my understanding. I've found it quite difficult, I don't know about you, since that first week when Joel introduced Revelation and mentioned that there's this like dualistic nature to Revelation and the way that good is presented versus evil in like this polarized binary, like that's been problematic for me. So I wanted to kind of look at that a little bit because, crudely put, once we've read these chapters, it seems like the capital G good are like vindicated and glorified and in heaven forever, and then the capital E evil are like eternally and viciously, vindictively punished in hell where the smoke of their torture goes up forever and they have no rest. Like, I found that problematic. I don't know about you. But without attempting to tackle the whole issue of hell, the vision in Revelation is not intended to be a decisive damnation or accurate depiction of what happens when people who are not saved die. That's not the intention. Rather, the demonization of empire and of unbelievers is actually intended just to vindicate the suffering and the lived experience of the early church trying to survive under the Roman Empire. And it was intended to dissuade them from conforming, taking that path of least resistance and just going with whatever the empire says, going with whatever social media wants you to do. And on the flip side, the glorification of saints, that presenting the good people as the capital G good, that's actually intended to inspire the perseverance that John is calling for throughout Revelation. So I think fairy tales are written in a similar sense. You know, they present these polarized characters of good versus evil, and they're not intended as like an ethics textbook or a philosophy textbook. They're just intended to encourage kids to live this way and to discourage them from living that way. And I think it would really help if we take that intention in Revelation, the book of Revelation, because when we take the whole of God's revelation, the whole of the different ways that God has revealed God's self to mankind throughout the scriptures, throughout science, and throughout our experience, we have to see that the nature of God is rich with complexity and even paradox to what we're able to understand today. Revelation alone can look like a binary good versus evil, but when you take everything as a whole, that is not the nature of God. There is complexity and nuance. So we realize that Revelation is the answer to the cry of every person who has suffered unjustly ever since Abel was killed by his brother Cain back in Genesis, so that along with all of the past saints and with all of creation, we too today are groaning and asking, as Joel said, how long, O Lord? Like, how long will suffering and oppression, how long will natural disasters and addiction and disease and corruption, how long will these things continue? How long will you allow evil or the dragon to have reign? How long will evil prosper? And how long will believers suffer? In long-awaited answer, echoing Jesus' cry of "It is finished" on the cross, we read in Revelation 16, verse 17, "It is done." And together, all the saints celebrate God's decisive action to set evil to account and to make all things new. Which brings us to our final installment of Revelation next week. Looks like it's going to be a massive exploration. But to finish this week, let's read Revelation. Yes, Revelation 15, verse 3 to 4, all together. "Great and amazing are your deeds, O Lord God the Almighty. Just and true are your ways, O King of the nations. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship you, for your righteous acts have been revealed." So I also loved that song we sang earlier. "I'm going to sing my heart out, praise on repeat, for the God who's never given up on me." So let us sing that song anew. "For all nations will come and worship the true Lamb and see through the impressive appearances." And now that we have this revelation behind the scenes view on the spiritual realm, we know that our suffering, our struggle, it's proof that injustice will be called to account, and that in the end, our God of love wins.